Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Hi, and happy April. It is April. I think it's my favorite month, not just because it's spring, but because I was born in the month of April, and I'm celebrating my birthday all month. I was fortunate to be born on Earth Day, April 22nd, and I don't think it's a coincidence that I really care about the planet, our home, planet Earth, and how important it is to nurture and appreciate the planet and everything that we get from it that nurtures us. We're going to be talking a little bit about that. We're going to be talking about organic farming in just a moment. But what's so wonderful about spring, if you're in New York at this time or anywhere else in the world where you're experiencing spring, it's when life, new life, becomes so apparent. All the lovely green buds on the trees and the sprouts coming up out of the earth all around us. And in some places, no matter how we try, we can't stop it even if we want to. It's really a beautiful, magical thing. And I really appreciate those who have a great respect for the earth and take care of it and do great things with it. And that's why we're going to be talking to Atina Difflay today, who is the author of a lovely new book, Turn Here Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. She is an organic vegetable farmer who educates consumers, farmers, and policymakers about organic farming through the consulting business Organic Farming Works, LLC, which she owns with her husband, Martin. From 1973 through 2007, the Difflays owned and operated Gardens of Egan, one of the first certified organic produce farms in the Midwest. And they have a website, organicfarmingworks.com. Welcome to It's All About Food, Atina.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
I am so excited to be talking to you. You have no idea. I loved your book. I just read it this week. And it's beautiful.
Thanks. I put my heart into it.
Well, that's very apparent. Your heart is all over this book. And so we're going to talk about some of it. One of the things that really amazed me is what an excellent writer you are. And, you know, usually when someone has a story like yours to tell, they get someone else to tell it. Were you journaling all along during your period as a farmer?
No, I've always journaled, but I never had edited my writing before. It was always raw because I never had time when I was running a farm.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a lot while I was taking produce orders on the phone. And the produce buyer would say something that I thought was interesting, and I would just sit and write about it while we talked. But I'd never put anything together before.
Now, one of the interesting things I found about your style of writing is the presence of time and how time progresses, because there are paragraphs that jump from one time to much later, and there's no real apparent mention of how much time has passed. And I appreciate that. I don't normally feel that in a book, and it just kind of gave me this feeling of continuity about how time marches on, and somehow the days are so, they pass, and so many are like so many others, and things move on.
I think time is very relevant to life on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as a farmer, we see time in an annual basis, and we see life on an annual level as vegetable farmers. We see that whole cycle of birth to growth to death in just 6 short months. So we have so many opportunities to really reflect on life and what it means and how it comes and goes and the renewability of it. So it creates a different sense of time.
There's a lot of things I loved about this book. And the first thing I want to mention is all of the art that's in it that you mentioned. And so you're not just farming, which is very, very difficult physical work, but there's art to it, there's love to it. And I loved that you named your son Camille Mays, because after the artist Pissarro, who I love and who has painted some really majestic landscapes.
And Camille Pissarro painted the Parisian suburbs before they became suburbs, when they were still market gardens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really why we gave our son the name Camille. is he was the last Diffley born on our family land, the fifth generation before it was bulldozed for suburban development.
Yeah, and it's a very sad, compelling story, and I'm not really sure how it could be done differently other than planned urban areas for people to live in and then leaving the farmlands alone to do what they need to do.
Well, I think we really have to have some serious thought put into where our food's coming from. And every single community in the world can have its fresh food grown right there in the community. It doesn't take a lot of land to grow fresh fruits and vegetables. So that can happen right in the community as we were doing in Eagan before we were developed out. In the city of Eagan, there was no land left for agricultural purposes. And that was really a loss.
We definitely need to rethink the way we think about food on so many levels. And we need to give organic farming our 110% support. And unfortunately, we've got corporations that are taking over our food production. One thing that drives me crazy is when we call industrial food or industrial farming conventional. There's nothing conventional about it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have a great paragraph in this book when you talk about certified organic. And I'm trying to see, I dog-eared it here, and if I can just read it, because it kind of sums it up in a nutshell, and it's so important. Oh, you write here, I explain soil building, rotation, biological diversity, beneficial insects, no chemical pesticides or synthetic fertilizers, 36 months in compliance with Minnesota organic standards. All of this is very complicated, very specific. How difficult is it to get organic certification?
Well, it's not hard to be an organic farmer, but it's knowledge-based. It's not a matter of input substitution and just using different products. All of our systems are really based on understanding our relationship with ecosystems and how they affect our pests and disease and fertility. So the act of doing that isn't onerous. It's just a matter of understanding basic knowledges. And the certification process itself is really quite well structured because the farmer basically has to keep their records and track what they're doing and make sure that they're in compliance with the organic system, write a system plan, and then go through the certification process.
How do you feel about the farmers that don't go through the certification process for lots of different reasons? They're overwhelmed by it.
I think they're missing a really valuable opportunity. And I'm going to say that for two reasons. One, certification protects the farmer. And when you read my book, that becomes really obvious when we had to fight the Koch industry, the Koch brothers, who wanted to eminent domain our second farm for a crude oil pipeline. One of the main reasons we were able to win in a major law court of law against someone as powerful as the Koch brothers, the largest privately owned company in the world, is because we were certified organic. And because we had an organic system plan, which is part of that certification process, it is actually a federally registered document admissible in a court of law. So it wasn't hearsay that we farm a certain way. We had evidence. We've seen organic certification also protect farms in Minnesota when they had drift issues, and it helped them in a court of law settle those cases. So that's one reason. It provides incredible protection for the farmer, which they won't have without the certification. The other reason I think it is so crucial is it's the only way the USDA can truly count how many farms are organic. And it is absolutely crucial that we make a very strong statement to the USDA that organic farming systems work, that farmers are doing it, and that consumers are demanding it. That's a big part of changing the system and getting the USDA on board with funds for research and for cost share programs and all the other policy changes that really do make a difference in helping farmers to change their farming systems. So it's a commitment to the movement and to having this whole process move forward.
I appreciate that. I really appreciate that explanation that you went into because, you know, I've heard so many different opinions, and I know that a lot of different farmers struggle with the thought of going through certification, and I agree. I think it's important on many levels.
You know, some people are concerned about the paperwork, and I feel strongly that any paperwork you keep for certification, you really need to keep anyways to be a quality farmer. You need really good records. And so those papers need to be kept anyways. And people should be really aware that there is a cost share program, and it pays up to 75% of the certification costs, up to $750. Mm. So that will actually cover the majority of a farmer's cost. If they're a small farmer, they shouldn't have more than a few hundred dollars beyond that.
That's very good to know, and I'm going to share that information. Thank you.
And then, of course, it helps them in the marketplace. If there is a certified organic grower and the consumer wants organic, they generally will pick that first.
You have so many wonderful stories in this book, and I just wanted, maybe you could retell a couple of them that I really enjoyed. One was where you had this problem in one field, or was it in your greenhouse with aphids?
Oh, yeah. It's a really great example of how organic farming systems work. We had an aphid infestation in our greenhouse, which is actually very rare. I've only had that happen to me one time in 25 years where I had a pest in the greenhouse. And my first thought when I saw them was, oh, I wonder if I used a little too much nitrogen in the mix in my compost. Because when you have excess nitrogen, it makes the cells grow really fast of a plant, and then they're thinner, and it's easier for the aphids and attracts them. So that was my first suspicion. And then my second thought was, I had just that morning seen in the vetch field, the hairy vetch field, that it was full of ladybug larvae, and I know that ladybugs love aphids. So it was a simple matter to load the pepper plants onto a hay wagon and drive them out to the hairy vetch field and leave them there for the day. And when I came back in the evening, those plants were covered with ladybugs and not aphids. They had consumed them all, and the problem was solved.
I love
it. And that's pretty classic of how organic farming systems work, where we're really working with biological balance to manage the pest and disease.
Well, I think, unfortunately, in industrial farming, they try more and more to take people out of the equation, and we really need people in the equation, and maybe those fields need to be smaller and more manageable so more people can get involved and really pay attention at a, not quite a microscopic level, but at the detailed level where they can really see what's going on.
You know, that example I just gave you is a really good example of present time, because to some people, it may look like we spent a lot of labor loading those plants and moving them out to the field, and that it might have been easier to just use a chemical pesticide to manage those aphids.
Mm-hmm.
But we were really using present labor and present energy and present time, in that we were right in that moment doing that task. Whereas if we had used a pesticide, we're actually using the stored time and the stored energy of fossil fuels. So it's actually a much more expensive use of time. But it's not as obvious to us in our society, because right now we're still putting such a low value on those inputs. And then we're also affecting the future when we use that pesticide by bringing a pesticide into the environment that's going to affect all the other species and the health of the people involved. So it really becomes much more expensive. And when you look at it that way, it starts to really make sense why these systems are so crucial for the planet.
Absolutely. And we need not to lose this knowledge for the few that still have it.
You know, this is why I wrote up the loss of the first farm to the suburban development in the Boulder Scenes as strongly as I did, because what I learned in that experience when our first farm was bulldozed was I understood ecosystem services and the ecosystem benefits we get that we take so for granted. And it doesn't mean we have to preserve every single tree or every single plant. That's not realistic. But what I saw happen there when they took that farm is they removed every tree and every plant, everything living, including the topsoil. And what happened was ecological collapse. We were continuing to farm immediately adjacent to this land that had been completely raped of everything living.
That's the word, raped, definitely.
We couldn't farm because without the adjoining life, we had no pest control. We had no birds to eat the insects. We had nothing alive in the soil to hold rain when it fell, so we had terrible erosion. And it was so obvious to me what we get from nature when I saw nature stripped. And as dramatic as those scenes are in my book, it's even more important to realize that agriculture is actually the leading cause of habitat degradation and species extinction, not development.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see it so obviously when it's development and they're just taking everything away. But the agricultural systems that we are now using with monocultures and large amounts of one form of life are actually causing far more harm.
There was another story that I liked about how you sat in a new field of freshly planted lettuce and or arugula, I think it was, and kind of in a meditation gave your wish to the deer not to come and eat. And it's something that worked one time, but maybe didn't work later on. But it was really, I loved that.
You know, I actually have a lot of stories similar to it that I could have put in a book, and I could have written an encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm.
I had to really choose stories carefully. But it is a practice I've always had, because everything we do affects nature. So we might as well ask nature how it feels about it. And whenever I've had a problem on the farm or some information I needed, I do go out and ask the plants, and I am amazed at how often I receive an answer.
Well, I've
and
heard
it
about.
It sounds a little woo-woo-ish, but it does. It is where the information is coming from.
You know, whether or not they really are communicating to you, it's that presence, being there, and not being arrogant about thinking you have all the answers.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of going in there and watching the plants.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was just thinking. Oh, there's a practice, I forget what it's called right now, where people go and into the fields and ask the plants or when they need to be watered.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
Well, I haven't read about it, but it makes sense.
Yeah. because the plants seem to know when they need whatever they need.
And different crops really need to have different water needs. It's really helpful to really understand. I really try to think about everything that's going on with the plant, where its roots are, how deep they are, what type of rooting system they have. Is it wide? Is it deep? Are they fat roots? Do they have a lot of fine hair roots? And then I like to think a lot about where the fruit is at and the food production, and that gives me a lot of information about what the plant's water needs are. And I think you said this very well earlier, whether that information is coming from the plant or not, just going in there and being quiet and listening and paying attention is really an important part of getting all that information.
Well, I've read that different organic farmers have different techniques where they might go in and look at different trees and see what's happening. And actually, if they see a mild infestation, they will manually pick off bugs and take care of them as needed, where needed. And it works on a small scale.
Well, it can actually work on a larger scale if you have it as a balanced system.
Mm.
And, you know, a good example we have for that is, like with potato beetles, we know we're going to have potato beetles and they can be very problematic. So what we really want to do is understand their life cycle. So, for example, we'll plant eggplants in the field where we had potatoes last year because we know those beetles will go straight to the eggplants. And we'll just put out maybe 10 of them in a field that was 2 or 3 acres. So that's quite a few potatoes. But because there's so few plants, all those adult beetles will go right to those plants, and it's really quick and simple to pick them off. So it's just a matter of, you know, outsmarting those insects. We should be able to do that. We do have bigger brains.
Can you talk about your children and their appreciation for vegetables and their diet of eating vegetables? We're going to be talking about that in the next part of the show, and I just was curious what your perspective was as a farmer.
Children inherently connect with nature. I have yet to meet a young child who didn't want to connect with nature and have a spirituality about it. So that was true for me as a really young child, and it certainly was true for my children when we were farming and they were young. They really were in those fields with us and doing everything with us, and it was their whole world, and it was really quite a spiritual experience for them. So my experience with children, all children, my children and children who have never eaten natural foods, is when you take them out in the field and they can pick that food fresh, they are almost always interested in eating it.
Mm-hmm. We bought some ornamental kale in the wintertime, and I have a little terrace in my apartment in New York City, and I try and grow whatever I can there when I can. And so we planted these ornamental kale, and one of them has just made it through the winter and is now growing really tall. It's amazing, and I've been picking off these lovely kale leaves and eating them. I love it.
You know, I think the really important thing for readers, I mean, your listeners, to really understand is that organic farming systems really do work. And they aren't complicated. They're actually very simple because they're simply working with natural systems. And the fertility is completely renewable. It's based on the energy of the sun and plants. And we've really got to move in that direction as a society. It's not like we're going to have synthetic fertilizer at our affordable fingertips forever. So it's exciting that we've got as much information about organic as we do, and we continue to get more, and things are definitely moving in that direction. So the more people can support it, the more will happen.
This book really has a great arc in it, and you begin talking about your romance with your husband, Martin. You talk about your romance with the farm and the life and the soil and the difficulties involved and dealing with all the unexpected things that come up, especially the weather. But then there's this other piece that makes this, I think the book would have been a great read even if you didn't have these extra challenges. But then you had these extra challenges of eminent domain coming in and bulldozing all the land around you. And then another problem of Koch Industries coming in, threatening to put a pipeline under your property. Where did you get the time, the energy, the strength to deal with these things?
Well, you know, there's anger and then there's love. And, you know, part of me up was angry. I was really angry at Koch Industries at their arrogance of not recognizing what was there that was serving. We were serving 50,000 consumers in the Twin Cities. And to not recognize the value of that was extremely arrogant. But more importantly, we were always acting from love. And when you are acting from love, you can always do the impossible. It's really amazing how that works. And so our love for the soil, our love for food, that's what really always pulled us through. And when you direct market produce, you have this opportunity to have no end of relationships. So as an organic farmer, it's the relationships with the soil and the other plants that are living in your ecosystem. But in that marketplace, we had literally tens of thousands of people that really cared about our farm and stood up for it. When we had to fight Koch Industries, over 4,500 people wrote letters. So that's really community, and that's what we're seeing in this food movement and in the organic movement is the power of community and what it can accomplish. So everyone getting out there in their very own communities, supporting their own organic farmers, standing up for them, getting involved with policy, that all comes together and makes a very powerful change.
Love and community.
That's
powerful, and that solves so many things, and without it, we're nothing.
Because anger will just burn us out.
Yeah. No.
And, you know, we do get angry. I got up every morning and had my little, I'm going to get those Koch brothers. But it wasn't what really propelled me.
Well, I think it's really important that we support local food. We support our farmers. We support our community. We have to buy organic. And, you know, when troubles come along, we're nowhere unless we have community around us.
Yeah, absolutely. We see that whenever someone's in trouble, how people rise up to help them.
Another crazy thing that you mentioned in this book that I noted was about drying clothes. And
yeah.
I don't know. I guess there was something in the back of our culture's mind that associated clotheslines hanging out maybe with poverty. And as we moved up and had more affluence, we didn't want to have that image. But I'm looking forward to that coming out, coming back. And maybe there's a way where we can have more attractive clotheslines that are more orderly.
Put them in the backyard.
But it's so annoying from so many levels.
You know, when you go to Europe, even in wealthy communities, they have clothes drying in the front yard.
Yeah, and it's crazy. Well,
we need to
raise the price of fuel and electricity so that drying clothes is really not affordable. And I mean, that's part of the problem. It's too cheap to waste energy. And we're so wrapped up in this, doing everything so quickly, that we have to get our clothes dried right away. And, you know, people talk about how they like the smell of these Bounce and these other artificial fragrances that are actually probably neurotoxins to make our clothes fluffy and smelling good. But there's nothing like putting clothes outdoors and drying.
Well, you know, people say it takes too much time, but if they figured out how much time and energy it took to dig that petroleum out of the ground and create the energy to run those clothes dryers, I think it's a lot less time to just hang them up. And again, it's present time, just like the example of the aphids and the lady beetles was.
Yeah, well, I dry my clothes inside in New York City, in a small New York City apartment. The sad thing is, though, that there are some people that want to dry their clothes outside, and they unfortunately live near horrific factory farms, especially in North Carolina, where they're growing a lot of the hogs confined in these factory farms, and the air smells horrible, and they can't dry their clothes outside because they get this horrific stench.
Yeah, and then as I have in my book, there's actually communities where outdoor clotheslines are forbidden.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know. I think that we can't dry our clothes outside at my apartment. It's a building rule. And it's nutty. And, you know, sometimes I do it. Don't tell anybody.
Well, I had a lot of fun with the clotheslines as a thread in the book. They keep showing up, and they're a character of their own.
Atina, I really loved your book. I think it should be, like, in all schools where children read about how to grow food and what it takes and get inspired by it. It's so important. It's a lovely book. Thank you so much for writing it. I feel so privileged that I could read it. And I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Thanks for joining me on It's All About Food.
Thanks for your work.
Okay. Have a great day.
You too.
We're going to take a quick break. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And while we're having this break, why don't you stroll over to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, and check it out. We'll be right back.